Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. I'm your host, Doug Nesbitt. On this week's show, Andrew Stevens interviews Paul Young, president of the Queen's University Faculty Association, about the union's recent round of bargaining in 2011 and the implications of the upcoming Drummond Commission report for Ontario public services, including the post-secondary education sector. But first, here's our weekly labor news update. On February 6, 11 men, including 10 migrant workers from the Caribbean and Latin America, were killed in a truck accident between Stratford and Waterloo, Ontario. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union has established a fund for the affected families at ufcw.ca. In the last decade, the use of temporary foreign workers in Canada has increased from 100,000 to a quarter million. An estimated 40,000 work in Ontario's agricultural sector and are unable to unionize due to the province's labor regulations. This has earned Canada condemnation from the United Nations agency, the International Labour Organization. Canadian Auto Workers Local 27 and their supporters continue to picket the electromotive diesel factory in London, Ontario, despite the announcement by Caterpillar to close the plant and move operations to Muncie, Indiana. The plant closure has caused widespread criticism of the federal government for its $5 million corporate tax break for the factory announced by Harper himself at the same factory in 2008. A number of regional retail stores have pulled Caterpillar products from their shelves in response. The Canadian auto workers have refused to end their pickets and vow to prevent anyone from entering the plant until they've received adequate severance packages. CAW President Ken Luenza has threatened an occupation if these demands are not met. Halifax transit workers struck on February 2nd after rejecting the demands of their employer, the Halifax Regional Municipality. The Amalgamated Transit Union Local 508, representing the workers, are still in negotiations with the city. Like the Ottawa Transit strike of 2008-09, management is attempting to assert further control over scheduling that would destabilize existing work schedules and prevent some workers from having weekends off. The City of Toronto and QP416, representing outside municipal workers, have reached a tentative deal in a controversial and highly publicized round of bargaining. It has been widely reported that the union has made concessions on seniority rights in return for wage hikes. Details of the agreement will not be released until after the ratification vote is held, a vote that has yet to be scheduled. The City of Toronto, led by anti-union mayor Rob Ford, has still to negotiate with the other municipal union, the 23,000-strong QP79. Stay tuned to Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM after these messages for our interview with Paul Young, president of the Queen's University Faculty Association.
On Monday, February 13th at 6:30 p.m., CFRC's Radio Residencies program celebrates its 7th annual funding drive and UNESCO's World Radio Day with the launch of two original documentaries, Veronica Blackburn's Some Remain So, Conversations About Mental Health, and Usman Mushtaq and Ekta Singh's Border Crossings, Story of an Immigrant Youth in Kingston. The event is free, however, donations are accepted for the funding drive. The shows will be launched at the screening room, so make sure you don't miss out and come out and support our residencies.
For the month of February, the Publishing and Compu Center is hosting Color Your February campaign. All color prints and copies will be sold for a reduced rate of 50 cents. The PNCC is located in the lower level of the JDEC. Visit today for your chance to color your February and save.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Rank and File Radio, a program about work, the labor movement, and sticking it to the man.
Tune in Wednesday evenings, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to Rank and File Radio. Here's our interview conducted by Andrew Stevens with Paul Young, president of the Queen's University Faculty Association.
I want us to start with a bit of discussion about your involvement and your history with the Queen's University Faculty Association. When did you start getting involved in, as an executive or really in the politics of CUFA?
My original involvement was doing grievances for them, which was back in the 90s. In fact, it preceded our unionization. Effectively, as a sort of a faculty mentor, you would interview people who were having problems, one form or another, with the administration, and then try and craft a solution within the with lawyers that we have or had at that time, but they were volunteering in the system at that time. Try and craft a solution that was acceptable to both parties, the administration and the individual. So having done that, and then getting deeply involved with the pension issue here at Queen's, because I understand investment and I understand pension plans, I was simply asked if I would be willing to be vice president. And I never actually quite understood the full implication of that. But in fact, the system is 2 years as vice president, 2 years as president, and 2 years as past president. So it was a 6-year commitment.
In the talk you gave earlier this month on public services and university finances, you mentioned the Drummond Report, which is, of course, authored by Don Drummond, a former chief economist with TD Bank. Tell our listeners a little bit about the report and what this means for colleges and universities in Ontario.
Okay, I would also add that Don Drummond is a CUFA member. He's a faculty member in policy studies here at Queen's, although I've never met him. The government of Ontario hired him, and I don't know if there were others hired as well, as a committee to look into ways to save money. That is, how do you change public services, budget allocations in such a way that the deficit can be reduced. And they typically, a committee of that type is charged with finding efficiencies or finding savings of one form or another. And he has taken that on, taken it to heart. He's produced a report, or at least an initial report, which has been sent to government, as I understand it. And there have been some press releases of items leaked from it. As far as I know, the whole report is not yet released and not available.
What do you think this is going to mean, or what are the implications for public services in general in Ontario?
I think that's pretty clear. Earlier this month in the newspapers, it was stating that for some public services, they are simply going to be privatized. They're looking for a 30% cut in the budget of some services. The McGuinty government has a stance that they will protect health care and that they will protect education. The Drummond Report, as the press release has said, again, the report itself is not really available for reading, suggests that health care will be held to a 2.5% increase year on year, and that education, post-secondary education at least, is going to be held to, I think it's 1.5% in the report, or 1% in the report, something of that order. So clearly below inflation at this point in time, at a time when costs in healthcare are running at +5%, +6% per year, and in education it would be several percent per year.
As the government responds to what are currently simply the preliminary suggestions or recommendations, do you think that we're going to be seeing a repeat of the so-called Ray days under the NDP premiership of Bob Ray, or worse, the cuts experienced under the Harris Conservatives?
I think we're going to see very substantial cuts. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They are determined to balance the budget in a relatively short period of time, and they spent very deeply to try and cushion the economy from the recession. It's going to be much more difficult to act now with a minority government than they might have acted if McGuinty had come back with a majority government. So they're going to have a slightly different strategy, I suspect. What McGuinty has said publicly is that it will be a government, or a liberal, I think is what he said, solution, even speaking from the position of a minority government. And so it's not clear that they will simply adopt all of the recommendations of the Drummond Committee, or if they will cherry-pick it for things that they find politically acceptable and sufficiently financially reasonable, or what they intend to do. That is very much up in the air at the present time.
Well, even though McGuinty has actually prided himself on a commitment to education, the government has nevertheless announced a cut of $42 million from research funding over the next 4 years. What is this going to look like for innovation and research in various fields across Ontario's universities and colleges?
I'll make just one small comment first, and that is I currently sit as chair of the Genetics Committee for the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, and I've chaired that panel for many competitions now. So I'm deeply involved with the medical research, medically oriented research grant system at the federal level. Any cut to research funding has an immediate impact in terms of personnel and programs. There's no doubt whatsoever about that. The particular funding that's been cut is a matching fund or at least targeted program of some form. And so it was to help Ontario universities do work where they could partner up, I think, with the private side as well. And so the removal of it will cost jobs, it will cost research programs, and ultimately the system at the present time is pretty tight. There's a lot of money, but there's also a lot of researchers and a lot of very expensive research is done. And so it will hurt. There's no doubt about that.
When you spoke at the Commission Forum on January 5th, you mentioned the worsening student-faculty ratio at Queen's, the cancellation of small programs, and really a worsening educational environment in general. Were these issues ever addressed during the recent round of bargaining between CUFA and the Queen's University Administration?
Yes, they're central to any faculty association bargaining with their with the administration. It's a broad trend. It's not just Queen's. It's a broad trend within the entire Canadian university system, pretty much. There's been a long-term increase in the student-faculty ratio. I told the commission that when I came here back in 1974, the ratio was 16 to 1. And Queen's was very proud of that. That was probably the lowest student-faculty ratio in Canada. There were about 10,000 students at Queen's at that point in time. The current ratio is closer to 27 to 1 on average across the campus. And if you were to look in the large science departments and perhaps in sociology and departments like that, you would probably see student-faculty ratios up in the 40 plus, maybe even 50 range at this point in time.
In a leaked letter in 2011 written by Principal Daniel Wolfe to the Board of Trustees Chair Bill Young, the principal wrote about the imperative to reduce the deficit at all costs. These are his words. He even emphasized that the university should be prepared for reputation-damaging labor actions, which he said may actually be necessary in the process of achieving salary restraint and pension reform. What effect did this letter and its statements have on negotiations that were taking place at the time between the university and CUFA?
The letter was in our hands very soon after it was leaked, from wherever it was leaked. But we chose not to comment on it, partly out of we weren't quite sure where it came from. We weren't quite sure if it was authentic for a substantial period of time, for instance. The general tone of it, I actually found a bit appalling. I mean, even thinking about it in terms of this is a private letter between an employee of the board, if you like, and his employer, pointing out where they're heading, I thought it was a bit much, and I think that was the general way it was perceived in the public realm when it became much more widely dispersed or distributed. The board has placed, and it's really coming from the board, a very strict financial regime or regimen on the institution, and providing a tight timeline to balance the budget. And keep in mind that the budget is being balanced at a time when resources are not increasing at the pace of inflation. So it effectively means squeezing everything. The outcome for arts and science, our largest faculty, is a loss of about 40 full-time faculty positions over the last 2 to 3 years. And because obviously faculty salaries are a major component of the operational budget, the failure to replace them is one way to save money. So it's generating a worsening educational experience. The stance that CUFA took was that it should be, if we have to balance the budget, I don't think anybody disputes that, that it should have a slightly slower rate of reduction of the operational budget, or at least the balancing process should take slightly longer. And that has always been our message to the ward and to the administration, to the principal and provost. There's no particular reason it had to be finished off for the 2012-13 budget, which is the way it sits at the moment. They could have taken another year or two and made it easier, I think, to accommodate.
What was your sense of support within CUFA for a strike if it came to that?
We did take a strike vote, and it was unanimous. And keep in mind that the mechanism for a strike has a Ontario Labour Board component to it. That is, there must be an anonymous vote ballot cast in order to have the membership vote on it. That's typically done in a closed room, in an annual meeting or something like that, or a meeting for a strike vote. We chose, and I'm a very strong supporter of this, we chose to have the vote both within the room where we had the meeting, the informational meeting, and we also had that meeting webcast around the world, and we had an electronic vote, which was acceptable to the Ontario Labour Board. It was anonymous and handled by a third party. And there were actually more people that voted on the electronic vote from places as far away as Sudan and Cuba and wherever our faculty members are. But we still had a very solid majority, and we reached a very solid majority of our entire faculty, instead of having a few hundred people in a room and having a vote and saying, well, this is it. So the vote to give a strike mandate to the executive, which is not a vote to strike, passed with a very strong majority. That then falls to the executive to make the decision, ultimately, whether or not to call a strike. The executive of CUFA has about 20 members, 18, maybe 18 members on it. They come from all the different groups on campus, by equity, by faculty, by expertise. It's a real mix of people, and they cover all stripes, if you like. And so when it comes down to it, in discussion with the negotiating committee or negotiating team and the executive, there were a lot of meetings. You watch the progress on the various issues. You have to make a decision on what you think are the critical issues. And, you know, in general, we fell to the side, and I think this is not atypical of faculty members, of issues of principle. Issues of fairness and equity would be foremost in most people's minds. And we held very firm on those within negotiations, and we were successful. When it comes to arguing salary, in the final case, the salary award was within 0.5% of what we were asking for anyway. And it would be very difficult to convince a University Faculty Association to go out on strike for 0.5% on salary. We did stand firm on the structure of the salary model, which has a progress through the ranks as well as an annual inflation-based across the board, which the university wanted to change. They wanted to abolish the salary model, or a major part of it. And we stood firm on that, and we probably would have gone on strike on that issue.
At the same time as CUFA was in negotiations, bargaining, three CUPE locals representing Queen's employees were also at the table. Was there collaboration between the unions leading up to bargaining? There's also the newly formed USW Steelworkers Local representing staff. What kind of interaction was taking place, if at all?
We have very close contacts with all of those unions. Some of the members of the executive are very much unionists, if you like, and very deeply into the solidarity issue. But it's also in our best interests. And a lot of that originated, we obviously have common interest in the success of Queen's, but it's too easy for an administration to pit the various unions against each other, because ultimately there is only one global income stream at an institution, and it has to be carved up amongst the various parties of interest within it. But we had one very strong common interest, and that was in the pension plan. We have a single pension plan, we have a single benefits plan, and we're all members of it. We all make use of it in slightly different ways within the staff and versus the faculty unions and so on. But what we did do, I mean, everybody recognized that the pension plan had to be fixed. The investment returns were low. The pension plan was in a structural deficit. As long as interest rates stay very low, it'll stay in a structural deficit. And the government was pushing for reorganization in order to allow solvency relief. They put a few criteria in place saying that if you would like to be freed from the requirement to make solvency payments, which are very onerous when interest rates are very low, and that would be the administration paying all of those liabilities, not the faculty per se, then you have to reorganize with certain criteria in order for the government to do that. So at this point in time, the Queen's Pension Plan has filed, or the university has filed, for solvency relief from the government with the changes to the plan that were put in place. But in terms of our relationship with the other unions, we were very closely cooperating with each other over the pension issue. In fact, we jointly hired an external actuarial firm, to have an independent calculation of all of the issues and costs of all of the changes to the plan, as well as where we would stand with respect to the government regulations if they were implemented. And we shared that cost three ways. So QP paid one-third, and steelworkers paid one-third, and CUFA paid one-third. Now, the steelworkers are still in negotiations, and they're still fighting over the pension plan, and we have agreed we will continue to share the cost of that actuarial resource until steelworkers has completed their negotiations. So we're still very, very actively involved with each other. I think in issues of major common interest, I think it makes tremendous sense to do this. It's partly a goodwill gesture, it's partly common sense.
As the province takes on the enormous task of attempting to reduce its deficit, as some of the anticipated results of the Drummond report are published, ultimately with the formal release of the report, what do you anticipate in 2 to 3 years' time for CUFA when you're back at the bargaining table? Do you think there's going to be old challenges coming up, or do you anticipate that at that point there might be some new conflicts or moments of tension?
Oh, what's coming forward? Well, it's a four-year contract, so we don't have to worry. Well, that's not really true. You start planning immediately, right? You try and choose your issues and do the research and generate a platform fairly early on, although we haven't really started yet. If the Drummond report comes through, there will be an additional six. Well, if the government's policies and the Drummond report come through in the way that we understand they're talking, we'll have at least an additional 60,000 students in the system. Keep in mind the university system, let alone the colleges in Ontario, are about, I think, 300,000 or even 400,000 university students. The province is committed to generating 60,000 new places, of which about 40,000 will be in the university. So about a 10% increase, you know, plus or minus, in the university student population, and 20,000 new places in the college system. If the budget increases in total, so the sum of the government grant money that comes through on a per capita basis, per student basis, and tuition, is held to what Drummond is recommending for the government side, which is about 1% or possibly 1.5%, that's below even current very low inflation rates. And the cost of operating the university is rising probably at least at 2 or 3%, maybe even slightly more than that. In the words of the Dean of Arts and Science, with the current budget structure, he says that the Faculty of Arts and Science must generate $2 million of additional money each year just to stay even, let alone rehire people who are retiring or anything else. So if that pressure is on the system, then there will be further faculty and staff reductions. There's no way out of it. So there will not be replacements of faculty who retire, and there will be a continuing pressure to close or merge small departments with larger ones. Although, some, you know, as often as not, the savings there are not tremendous because the faculty are still in place. It's not that you can fire them when you do that. And so the savings tend to be at the clerical side, the staff side, not the faculty side. And so there are some economies of scale. There's no doubt about that. But that just affects the attrition rate in other unions. So the operational budget is going to be tight and squeezed if that's where it stands. The government is probably not in a position as a minority government to strongly increase tuition fees. In fact, what they've done is to give this 30% reduction in the tuition fees for most of the regular students, although they left out some categories, which is welcome, I'm sure, by the students and their families and so on. However, they haven't really said where that money is going to come from. I think I said in the speech to the commission that it wasn't clear whether this was going to be new money that is allocated from somewhere else in the Ontario budget to the college and university system. McGuinty has since said that it will not be new money, but I'm not sure, I don't know that it's clear whether it will be money from the college and university portfolio, the post-secondary education portfolio, in which means basically that it will be a cut to some other aspect of their budgetary regime in that portfolio to the institutions. So the money will go back to the students. It will be effectively saying the grant per student from the government is going to be capped at perhaps 1% per year. And broadly within the portfolio where that money comes from, the tuition income is going to drop by a third. And that money will then be distributed, unless they have some other means of making it up. Perhaps these $42 million in research grants that they've canceled, maybe they think that's part of education.
All right, it's a challenging road ahead for students, faculty, and everyone else at Queen's. All right, well, in our studio today was Dr. Paul Young, CUFA president. That concludes our interview. Stay tuned to Rank and File Radio.
That was an interview with Paul Young, president of the Queen's University Faculty Association. Thank you for listening to Rank and File Radio here on CFRC 101.9 FM out of Kingston, Ontario, and we'll see you next week, Wednesday, 5:30 p.m. on this same station, CFRC 101.9 FM.